Today we have Dr. Urey, Dr. Wood, and Dr. Gold will present briefly what they said earlier today and try and put that in some sort of context, and I think we'll start with Dr. Urey and then come down this way.
Well, a year ago in Nice, I talked about the same subject I talked about today, and I made a suggestion that a couple of people have found interesting. Namely, how do you get the little moons of Mars? They are moving in circular orbits, and the orbits lie in the plane of the equator of Mars. This is a very special position. How do you get them there by any process, first of all? Second, they look to me like fragments of rock from somewhere that were big craters on. And so this is the way they could move, with the least moving through the gas in any way. Now, a couple of people approved of this. I find it's rather seldom people approve of what I say, but they did. But then you turn around and ask, did the other planets have nebulae too? Well, why not? How about those four little satellites of Uranus? Why didn't they capture in the same way? Well, why not? I think maybe they did. Then you go to those that have big moons attached to them. Saturn has five little moons inside the orbit of Titan, and then looks as though one was missed somehow. Then Titan comes, and a little one outside of Titan. I say missed because the orbits, the radii of the orbits have a regular pattern, and one seems to be missed. Well, was Titan captured? I think possibly two. All of them were captured. And this is the sort of thing I talked about so far as trying to say something about the origin of the whole solar system in 15 minutes. Well, this is impossible. Well, these were the points that were sort of new points I made. I do think, however, that lunar gas spheres are possible physically, and I think that we could account for quite a number of things that we see in our meteorites and in the structure of the moon from them. For example, a student of mine, Janet Bainbridge, working with me 10 years ago, pointed out that the surface of the moon may well have originated in a hot, melted condition, and the interior not. And this is a sort of model that is being tossed around a bit at the present time. And if so, she, in her paper, predicted this first, I think. Well, these, I think, are the interesting points that I tried to make today. Tommy?
Well,
or do you want to quiz each one of us separately?
Huh? No, that's maybe. Right. Why don't we just present them all, and then we can have questions afterwards.
Shall we? Well, I am very disturbed that one is taking one line of investigation as the only possible one line of fitting together the basic facts, and that is the line that essentially starts out with the knowledge that the large flat plains are lava flows. I've always said that I regarded that as a very uncertain piece of information, and all that's happened over the years seems to me to have even begun to shake the confidence of the proponents of that. We've not found any young volcanism on the moon any place, although it wasn't for want of searching for it. The missions were directed time after time in the best way that one thought of finding young volcanics on the moon, and none were there. The radar and the seismic evidence deny that there's any sort of a continuous sheet of rock closely underfoot. the flow patterns, of which I showed a picture that was taken to be lava flow, indication of lava flow, being clearly a flow pattern, those flow patterns occur in other circumstances, plentifully on the moon. Other circumstances looking just alike, where you would certainly never think of them as being a lava flow pattern, like a whole big hillside, all having got that same edge of a flow pattern along its whole periphery. And where they occur in the middle of Mare surface, we know from the radar that there is no solid rock at a depth of a few feet underneath. And yet, if you see the lobate flow pattern and think that it was due to the lava underneath having that pattern, it would have to be very closely underneath, because the whole step is only 2 or 3 meters high. And if you think that the lobate lava flow pattern underneath was under 100 feet of powder, well, then that step would long have disappeared, of course. So you cannot have it either way, and I'm firmly convinced by now that these same patterns that we see close to mountains are not lava flows, and that they're the same as the patterns we see right in the middle of the Maria, and therefore that there is a process at work, or has been at work, which transports large amounts of material over big distances. Now, the most startling evidence in recent times we have that the basic picture of making the powder from the rock underneath is incorrect. That evidence now seems to me absolutely overpowering. We know that if we had to make it from the stuff underneath, we would have to have impacts slashing through whatever layer of powder there is at any one time to knock out more from the rock underneath and grind it up, and that would be the way in which such a layer would have grown. But in that case, of course, you have to turn over the material in that layer many, many times in the process of grinding it all up into fine stuff. If you were to take the estimate of how many times you must have turned it over from the surface exposure effects that are measured on the grains. So we observe on the grains various surface exposure effects that tell us approximately how long a grain has been resident on the surface, 10,000 years or so. If you take that and say that was due to a mixing process, then you find that you have to have mixed the material down to a depth of a few meters thousands of times. You would have to have turned it thousands of times in order to give each grain the required high probability that it would have spent some time as the topmost grain on the surface. As I say, just as if you take a deck of cards and you argue, I'll shuffle it and see which card ends up on top, and I have to shuffle it often enough so that every card has a chance of ending up on top, because all the grains, almost all the grains, show the exposure. So then you've turned over the ground thousands of times for that reason, or for the reason of grinding it up from the rock below. But then that very same ground shows you layers, in some cases sharply delineated within less than 1 centimeter, many layers, 50 layers in one core sample, sharply defined for particle size, for chemical composition, for trace element concentrations, and so on, making clear that you are looking, at least in many areas, at soil that has not only not been turned over 1,000 times, but not been turned over once. You cannot have it that meteorite impacts would cause one patch to be turned over thousands of times, and another patch, neighboring perhaps, or nearby, not to be turned over once. Now that is statistically an improbability we don't even need to begin to discuss. So therefore, the model that the ground has been plowed over, dug up from underneath, from the rock, manufactured into fine powder by plowing by meteorites, and that that is all that has essentially happened, that model seems to me to be stone dead. What can I have as alternative? Well, I can have as alternative that there is material sedimented onto the surface. We know that meteorites have occurred, you see, so it's no good saying there's never been any plowing by meteorites. But what we can do to allow it nevertheless to be present in layers is just what we do on the Earth, of course. We can have on the Earth layers, despite the fact that other violence is taking place, by sedimenting stuff fast enough. Just a question of what is fast enough. If you were to deposit in the lowlands on the moon, which is what we have mostly looked at, layer after layer after layer, and you do it fast enough, then there'll be a high probability that very few areas have been plowed over by meteorites. But you must have a process that can deposit material without mixing it up. And meteorites cannot. It's no good saying you had a big impact over there that showered a layer over a region 1 centimeter thick, because if there was a big impact over there that was big enough to dig to a different chemical composition than the very surface layer, then it must have been far enough away and the ballistic speeds of the thrown out material are much too high to allow you to lay down a neat layer. It would get all mixed up over meters, many meters, and not centimeters. So I can't see that you can allow layers to be formed by impacts. You must have had a surface migration process. And the moment that you have a surface migration process on a big scale, then the whole of the other argument collapses. The whole of the conventional argument collapses. You do not know in that case where the stuff has come from. You know there's a regional difference in composition, and that's essentially all you know. And you have no real argument anymore that the flat stuff is lava flows. And with all that, then goes your conviction. You're no longer then sure that the material that you see as forming the dust, the so-called regolith, that material is locally made on the moon. Because once you have surface migration, then it is perfectly possible that is material which in part or in major part is itself the last addition to the moon. Of course it is chemically sorted material. Of course it has been through a differentiation process. It is basalt-like, I know all that. But then we do have basaltic meteorites. We have clear evidence that there were other bodies than the present ones on which some chemical differentiation had occurred on a large scale. We're pretty clear that those got smashed up again and reaccumulated, and which particular component formed the last few kilometers on the moon is a matter for lunar research to decide and not to preclude that argument by an arbitrary assumption to start with. I see no reason for thinking that we have not seen the primitive material out of which the last layers of the moon were made, and it could perfectly well be that very regolith whose age is excessively old. It's the oldest component, and that would after all fit, whose contamination with solar wind exposure and cosmic rays is the highest, and that would fit because that it would survive that on infall, and it would bring in what exposure it had while it was in orbit. All that would fit perfectly well. The only reason why people don't accept that is because you cannot accept that without assuming that there's a surface migration process that has redistributed it over the moon. Otherwise, of course, you blanket the moon uniformly, and that's not the case. So it is dependent on assuming that there is a surface transportation process, but the moment you do assume that, you have no case anymore that that stuff is not itself the infall material. I must say, I find a sentence in the Lunar Science report very revealing for the degree of preconception that goes into the picture. And that sentence is, we have not yet seen any of the primitive lunar material. Well, you think about that sentence a little bit. What does it mean? It means that you know that none of the material you have seen can be primitive lunar material. But why not? Because you assume that something would have happened to it. Obviously, I can make the moon out of the stuff that I now find the moon to be made of. You know, that's ridiculous. Obviously, if I assemble it, you know, it can be made what it's now made of. So the only way that statement can be meaningful is to say we knew for other reasons than what we found on the moon that the moon was made out of different stuff than the stuff we now find. But I completely deny these other reasons.
Dr. Wood? Well, my general line of work is to study rocks and to try to figure out how they formed and how they were related to each other. My training is in geology, and I have to say at the outset that
I can't really see why these parent source planets would have been so successful in differentiating rocks if the moon was a total failure at it. Anyway, that's not what I want to talk about. I'm trying, along with the other people in my field, to understand why these different kinds of lunar rocks exist on the moon. And it's not so easy. They are clearly related to each other, and yet the nature of the relationship is sometimes very sticky. And one of the things that impressed itself upon all of us was that one of the most enigmatic rock types of all on the moon, namely the creep norite, or whatever you want to call it, that was discovered by the Apollo 12 and 14 missions, is very unevenly distributed over the lunar surface. And this was elucidated in the paper this morning by Metzger, Arnold et al., and I think you've heard it at the last Lunar Science Conference as well. So here's a rock whose petrologic relationships is hard to understand, and it turns out that it's not spread evenly around the moon or randomly around the moon, but it's concentrated in one quadrant of the moon. And this sort of brought to my attention again the fact, I might say that the times I've had occasions to give talks to lay audiences, this has been a point that always concerned them, and I would always get a question from the audience at the end, and somebody would say, well, why are there Maria on the front of the moon and not on the back? And I put this question off as many times as I could in conscience, you know, with some kind of glib answer, and then finally it occurred to me that you really ought to worry about this. And if you understood that question, maybe you would have better luck at understanding the petrologic questions that are associated with it. So I have made a start at trying to investigate the asymmetry of the moon. I haven't gotten so far as the goal that I speak of being able to relate rock types, but the talk that I gave today had to do with a beginning in this direction. The most prominent asymmetry in the moon is one that was described by Bill Calla this morning, namely the fact that the center of mass of the moon is not coincident with the center of figure. They're separated by more than 2 and less than 3 kilometers, I guess, in the sense that the center of mass of the moon is closer to the Earth than the center of figure is. And this means that the weight in the moon is arranged unevenly. And if you accept a rather simple model of the moon as consisting of a dense mantle overlain by a low-density crust, and this is what seismology tells us is the case, at least in the vicinity of the stations where they have seismometers, if you accept a model like that, then in order to reconcile the fact that the center of mass is closer to the Earth than the center of figure, it means that this low-density crust has to be substantially thicker on the back of the moon than it is on the front. It has to be about twice as thick. And this led me further to try to ask what it was that might make the crust thicker on one side of the moon than on the other. And there are several possibilities that when a large impact occurs on the moon, it splashes material around and deposits it elsewhere. And you might say, well, what good does that do? Because after all, the impacts hit on all sides, and it would just shift the stuff back and forth. But it turns out that if you assess the distribution of impacts on the moon under various conditions, that there are some conditions where the bombardment pattern is quite biased. It's not evenly spread around the moon at all. And the one that I showed in this talk today treated the circumstance where the moon was still in orbit very close around the Earth, only about 3 times the present radius of the Earth away from the center of the Earth. And under those conditions, one side of the moon gets bombarded more than twice as densely as the other side. The side that gets bombarded is the leading edge or face of the moon that it presents as it goes around in orbit. We assume that the moon has already locked in so that one side is always oriented toward the Earth, and that 90 degrees away from that there's a face that's always plowing through the rainstorm, as it were, as it goes around the Earth. And it turns out, I made a computer analysis of the density of impacts on various sides of the moon, and it is much denser there. So, but that's not the place where the moon has the thinnest crust, and so you can't immediately leap to your feet and shout Eureka, because you may have succeeded in thinning one side of the moon selectively, but it's the wrong side. You'd like to have the side that faces the Earth be thin. Well, it turns out that if you thinned the moon's crust in one place, that the moon will probably shift its orientation relative to the Earth anyway. Now, it's not so straightforward as saying that that west limb of the moon will then move around obligingly and point toward the Earth. It's a much more complex thing than that. But the side that the moon presents to the Earth is not just an accidental choice of some side that it presents. It is related. It is determined. It is dictated by the distribution of mass in the moon. And we express this distribution of mass in terms of the moments of inertia, the principal moments of inertia of the moon. And I tried to perform an analysis which would not only bombard the moon and redistribute its crustal material, but would also readjust its position periodically in order to keep it in what the moon would consider to be a stable orientation. And so it was a series of steps of bombing and then twisting and bombing and twisting and seeking out the position that the moon wants to twist to. And I got that's really about as far as it went. I presented evidence that there are systematic effects, that the maximum thickness of the crust gets higher and higher in some places and the minimum thickness gets lower and lower in others, and that the center of mass and the center of figure of the moon move apart. All of this assumes you start with a spherically symmetrical moon, and that they approach values like those observed for the real moon, and that the moments of inertia of this hypothetical moon begin to approach values similar to those for the real moon. So this hasn't really proved that that's what's happened. I think so far it seems like you can make an internally consistent model of how the moon's orientation has evolved while it was being bombarded by this early intense bombardment that everybody acknowledges happened to the moon in early times.
Do we have questions?
Well, Dr. Wood, that original leading edge western limb, do you think it moved to become the what we call a far side now? I wasn't quite straight on which way.
It's not. I used to think you could make some simple statement about which way it would reorient itself after you had bombed that side of the moon. In fact, the bombardment pattern is a rather complex one, and the pattern of thinnings and thickenings that you get on the moon is even more complex. And the moon reorients itself in a rather funny way. What happens, the first cycle is really all I can follow very clearly. It thins a strip fairly close to the equator, stretching from pretty close to the sub-Earth point all around the west limb to the back of the moon. It does most of its thinning there. And then this thin region will reorient itself so that instead of being parallel to the equator, it's perpendicular to the equator. And then it's going to be either facing toward the Earth or away from the Earth and up toward the North Pole somewhat. So it's rather complex and not something you can easily predict, and you have to compute it out.
Why do so many people now preface their theories on the assumption that the moon was much closer to the Earth at one time than it is now? What do we know that would lead us to believe that?
We know the main datum there is the fact that the moon is now moving away from the Earth. This is actually an observable phenomenon. So if you extrapolate back...
Wait, could you give a number on that?
Centimeter. Well, the embarrassment is rather the other way around, that it's moving away at a rate which would make it very hard to see how it could have failed to have been excessively close to the Earth as recently as 2 billion years ago. Yes. One is straining hard to find some reason why the tidal friction in the past should have been less than what it is now in order to allow the moon to have lived for 4 billion years or whatever, in the vicinity of the Earth rather than for as little as two.
It appeared in pre-Apollo times, if you simply extrapolate that right back, that as Dr. Gold says, the moon must have been close to the Earth quite recently, and this was all knocked into a cocked hat by the ages of the rocks and everything which they got back, which were not that young.
It's in disagreement with that.
It's
into a cocked hat because we don't know how that disagreement is to be resolved.
Well, explanation for the discrepancy that most people are satisfied with is that the original analysis, which extrapolated back in time, made the assumption that the phase angle between the Earth's tidal bulge and the Earth-Moon line, in other words, the Earth has a tidal bulge which is not pointed straight at the moon, it's off at an angle a little bit. And the rate at which the moon recedes from the Earth may depend upon the size of this angle. And the original analysis was that this angle is a constant, and there's really no basis for making this assumption, and so most people are content to say, well, that assumption must have been wrong.
Well, I mean, what that implies is that the structure of the Earth must have been substantially different in the past from what it is now, because it is the structure of the interior of the Earth that fixes the degree of tidal friction there is. And one isn't too ready to accept some drastic change in the frictional effect in the interior of the Earth over geologic time.
One of the important frictional sources is the oceans. And the friction comes if you have a shallow shore and the waves and the tides roll up over the shallow shore. Well, it may be in the past that the shores were not so shallow. It looks as though we had continental drift. The continents were all in one piece instead of two. That decreased the amount of tidal effect very substantially. There are all sorts of things like that that could have changed it.
Dr. Gill, you talked about the surface migration and being a must under your theory. I'm not sure what type of surface migration this would be and what form would it take.
You're talking to me?
No, Dr. Gill. Yeah.
What form of surface migration do I need? Well, what I need for the observed effects on the moon is a process that will, on an average, take material from higher to lower ground, that will deposit it flat, that will take it sufficiently gently so that it does not mix much with the surface onto which it is being deposited, even though both are fine powders. So I must not slash it there with violence. I must deposit it there quite gently. And I must have that process proceed at a mean rate, which is fast enough so that the rate at which, on average, material is being deposited in the low ground is higher than the rate at which it is being plowed over by meteorites. And we know a little about the meteorite plowing rate, not too much, but we must have it deposit fast enough so that much of the material keeps protecting itself from being plowed over by having added to itself enough stuff. Yes?
I'm still not exactly sure what form
is the mechanism?
This would take. Mechanism
well,
of
the
it.
Mechanism is another matter, you see. I want sharply to distinguish between what the observations require must have taken place and my particular guesswork as to how such an effect could have taken place. Well, how such an effect could have taken place, I think, is by the secondary effects of electron bombardment, which occurs chiefly in the tail of the magnetic tail of the Earth. You should think that on the surface of the moon, in the top millimeter, all that energy is dissipated, which on the Earth, for example, makes the aurorae. So what is an aurora in the deep atmosphere of the Earth, without in a body without an atmosphere, that same effect is occurring right on the surface. And we have to investigate the electrical consequences of this kind of bombardment striking the surface. We do that in the lab, and we do indeed produce a very vigorous migration of small particles over the surface. And we have beautiful movies of how the small grains, including genuine lunar materials, redistribute themselves in the face of the kind of electron bombardment which does occur in the Earth's magnetotail. that gives an gives automatically a good reason why front and back of the moon are treated differently, because front and back, you remember, are only in relation to the Earth, front and back. To the solar wind, they're treated alike, and to the solar radiation and all the rest. But they're different if the relation is to the Earth's magnetic field. And the kind of auroral effect that is striking the surface of the moon, that is certainly quite different on the side facing the Earth as on the side away from the Earth. So it is a very natural explanation that if electrical phenomena are involved, that they would not have treated the front and back alike.
Yes. Dr. Gold, is this process still continuing, you believe? And if so, how fast?
Yes, I believe it is continuing. I believe it is going now at a rate much slower than it was in early times. And the reason for that is the following, that the bottleneck in any such process is that particles get glued together. And if a particle sits on another for a long time on the surface, there are processes that deposit other atoms to the junction point and gum it up, glue it together. It then is stuck with a slight force, but stuck hard enough so that none of these electrical forces can pick it up. I therefore think that an occasional massaging by impacts is essential to prevent the system from freezing up altogether. And in the past, there is no question but that the rate of infall has been much higher, you know, when you were still on the tail end of the very processes that made these bodies, then of course the rate at which stuff was still dribbling in was enormously more than it's now. If the rate of electrostatic migration is dependent upon freeing the material from its adhesion, and that's the only effect that's violent enough to free it that way, if it's dependent on that, then of course the rates in the past would have been much more than what they are now. The other effect is when the moon was closer to the Earth, it was also in the stronger bombardment region in the Earth's magnetotail.
Dr. Urey?
I've had a model in regard to this for quite a long time that I should like to mention. In the first place, it seems to me that there has been movement on the moon of the type that Gold talks about. I have thought that for a long time. But I believe the source of the material that is being moved about the moon is the moon itself. And my model for it has been and is now that we had a gigantic melting process about 4.5, 4.6 billion years ago that melted the surface of the moon to some depth. It then solidified. It cooled off and solidified. We had a differentiation that produced the rocks that we see in the anorthositic rocks and the basaltic rocks and probably some other kinds of rocks down below. Now, what happened was that an insulation process developed on the surface of the moon when it cooled off, got fragmented, became insulated, and now the basalts that had a high concentration of the radioactive elements got hot. On the Earth, they would have separated into a nice layer of liquid and some solids below, and the liquid would have flowed out and give us a nice solid lava flow. On the moon, in its lower gravitational field, this didn't occur, and both the solids and the liquid came out as an ash flow. We know of ash flows on the Earth, and this dust mixture of glass and stuff was blown up by gases and flowed out on the surface of the moon. And so we had what Dr. Gold wants, a layer of basalt on the surface of the moon that was produced indeed from beneath the surface of the moon in this way. Now, a basaltic, an ash flow, contains globs of liquid so that you can have some rocks once in a while, and you can have a solid lava flow perhaps someplace, or you can have a dusty ash flow in which there are no rocks below. And it seems to me this is the most likely source of the material that we see of this kind that you talk about on the moon. But of course, your electrical processes may move it about and so forth to some extent.
But why is the dust the oldest component in that case? Why is it older than any of the rocks? If that were the process, then it should be younger.
It isn't really. It's not that simple. And I'm not really qualified to discuss it. But when you say the dust is older, you're talking about a model age, not an isochron age.
Yes, that's right.
And the rocks themselves have similar model ages. They also have these old
that's
model
right.
ages.
What we
and
had
to,
was...
to make a simple statement like that the dust is older than the rocks is just
certainly
not
enough
right.
consistently younger.
But,
and if Wasserberg were here, he'd hit the ceiling.
But the...
No.
The point
no,
is...
No, no,
the
no,
point
no,
is that on the moon, make. On the moon with its weak gravitational field, the separation of the melted liquid and the solid doesn't occur readily. And at one time, there was a big event of some kind that started this thing out, and a mixture of liquid and solid flowed out on the moon. And it gave a model age back 4.5 billion years ago and an isochron age of 3.9 or something else.
Wasserberg replied to that same point on a previous occasion by saying, maybe we need an admixture of another component of a few percent of much greater age in the dust.
I know. He's
that is a very difficult thing to account for. That's a very difficult thing
to
account for.
You have to understand, Jerry. You have to understand.
Well, all right. But, I mean, that was his reply then. So it was not an easy matter to get out of that because no one likes the idea that this proves that there's another component vastly older than 4.6 billion years.
Going back a moment to your earlier statement, Dr. Gold, I'm a little confused as to the role of the magnetic tail as it sweeps across the moon. Now, as I understand your analysis, the movement of the dust is a direct consequence of what might be called an electrical blowing of the solar wind. What is the effect of the tail sweeping across the moon this?
It so happens that the type of bombardment which is experimentally found to be most effective in causing the dust to become stirred up and move is electrons in the energy range of 200 volts to 1,000 volts, medium energy electrons. So that is what is known in the vicinity of the Earth as auroral electrons, things that cause the aurorae in great abundance. Electrons in that energy range are practically absent in the free stream solar wind. They're generated from the solar wind when it hits the Earth's magnetosphere by taking energy away from the protons and sharing it with the electrons. In the free solar wind, they did not share their energies. So the result is that the Earth's magnetosphere gives you these medium energy electrons, which without it, you don't have. Those electrons then move on orbits, which are determined by the structure and shape of the Earth's field, including its long tail. And the moon moves at the present time through this tail for about 4 days each month. In the past, when it was closer to the Earth, as we're sure it must have been, it would have been a larger proportion of the time each month that it moved through this. We think that it needs just those electrons to really agitate the surface, and so therefore that the presence of the moon in the magnetotail of the Earth was an essential component to the story. Well, as I tried to say earlier, the examination of the moon and its layered features and so on makes clear to me that some transportation has taken place. I then go away and do the best I can in homework in my laboratory and so on to decide what is the most effective process that can satisfy these criteria, that it must shuffle the stuff down very gently, denude the highlands, deposit on the lowlands, at a slow pace so as to not disturb the layering and so on. And when I do all that, then I come up with a suggestion, no more, that this kind of electrostatic process would work. I then go to my lab and I try it out in the lab and it works very nicely, and then thrown into the bargain, I have the advantage that that process obviously makes a big difference between front and back of the moon.
For Dr. Wood, if, as you suggest, the moon's leading edge acquires a greater number of impacts and there's dust thrown around to the back edge, wouldn't there also be a greater crater count on the leading edge, and a corresponding sort of blanketing over on the other side of the moon?
Well, the thing is this. The leading edge effect works most effectively while the moon is in close to the Earth. That's why I ran the calculation very close in like that. When it gets out to its present distance, the bias in impact distribution is almost absent. There's hardly any at all. So what the history could have been, what it would have been if this thing worked at all, would be that the early intense bombardment while the moon was close to the Earth succeeded in thinning the crust preferentially in some areas, but that since then, and in the latter eons of geologic history, and since the moon has been out close to its present position, it has received additional impacts, more or less randomly distributed, which have established most of the pattern that you see right now. That plus the fact that, as I was saying, the moon would probably be continuously reorienting itself all the time that it was being bombarded, so all sides would get a more equal chance at being bombarded than I seem to have indicated.
One more question, I think.
Dr. Urey, on the moons of Mars, would you expect them to have the same chemical composition as the moon of Earth?
I would think that they would have a composition similar to some meteorites. That's what I would expect. But which meteorites, I wouldn't be able to say. I doubt if they're metal meteorites, iron meteorites. They look to me as though they were probably stone meteorites, composition of some kind. That's as much as I could say. Now, there are people that are investigating such things. McCord investigates the composition of the surface of objects by studying the light that is reflected from him. And if he has studied these, I don't know that.
The backscatter. They have a dusty surface.
They have a dusty surface.
I gather you think that all the lunar-sized objects around the solar system were formed in places other than the planets that they now orbit.
I've argued that for 10, 15 years. Argued it isn't quite the word. I present it as a possibility. And I say it's a curious thing that you find that there are seven objects in the solar system that within a factor of two have the mass of our moon. Very curious. Now, the small objects that you see in the asteroidal belt and the small moons and so forth, well, I have tried to add up their masses, and I thought perhaps they have a total mass of about the fourth of the mass of our moon. A whole bunch of things. It may be wrong because there may be smaller objects sailing around all sorts of places that we don't see. But it's very curious that we have these objects like that. It's improbable business.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.